We're only half done. They walk, fingers still woven together, to the tenth hole. It's a cloud, Ryan says. The whole thing is a cloud. They become so caught in their discussion of golfing within clouds that they don't hear the footsteps, don't hear the laughter coming their way. Then the voices are too loud to ignore. Ryan turns and sees who's coming. What? Avery asks. And Ryan says, oh, shit. Harry is crying. He is in so much pain that he's started to cry. His legs are seizing up, and his bladder feels like it's full of rocks, and he isn't choosing to cry, but his eyes are crying nonetheless. He's lost control of them. He's lost control of everything, except for his lips. All of the control that he has left, he has to put there. Even as his body is shouting, surrender, even as his mind is telling him there is no way to last another 5 hours. There are four of them. Avery has no idea who they are, and neither do we, but just like us, Avery has some idea of where this is going. It's the sneering looks, the swagger in the walk, the almost aimless spite in their laughter. It's a particular brand of asshole, easily found in teenage boys traveling in packs. "What's up, Ryan?" one of them taunts. "Who's your boyfriend?" Ryan lets go of Avery's hand. "What do you want, Skylar?" he says. "We saw a car out front. What are you boys up to?" Avery sees now that Skylar and one of the other guys are holding golf clubs. Skylar sees him looking and smiles. Then he spots a bottle on the ground and swings the club, knocking the bottle in Ryan and Avery's direction. Ryan doesn't flinch, but Avery does. We don't need to tell you what Skylar's like, do we? You must already know. In the big scheme of things, he's a powerless cog. So he exerts as much power as he can in any situation he can dominate. He tries to build his self-worth on the backs of others, and it works a little, but never enough. It doesn't make him any smarter. It doesn't give him more of a future. It gives him the same instant gratification as sex or drugs. He doesn't hate Ryan. Not really. He just sees in him an opportunity to be in control, especially with an audience. Ryan tries to stay away from him, tries to stay away from all of them, because there are always more of them, and because if he fights them, he's going to have to fight them every day after that, whereas if he manages to avoid them, ultimately he will disappear altogether. Or that's what he's told himself. That's what we always told ourselves. Do not engage. Do not make it worse. Walk away. Not run away. Don't be a coward. Don't let them see your fear. Walk away. If Avery wasn't here, that's what he'd be doing. Tell them to have a fun game, then walk away like he was handing over the course to them. But there's no getting away with that now. It's more fun for Skylar to go for the kill with Avery watching. Skylar lines up another bottle, and this time it smashes on impact, glass flying everywhere. The other guys find this hilarious. Avery can feel himself shutting down, going into survival mode. "What the fuck do you guys want?" Ryan spits out. "So tough," Skylar mocks. Then he throws his golf club at Ryan's face. Or at least he makes it look like he's going to throw the golf club at Ryan's face. At the last possible moment, he holds on to it. But not before Ryan's lifted up his arm, cringed from the blow that never comes. Avery can see Ryan's humiliation at falling for the fake-out. As the guys are laughing some more, Avery wants to walk over and put a comforting hand on Ryan's back, wants to tell him it's okay. But he can't do that, because he's not sure what kind of reaction that will get. And also, he's not sure if it really is okay. What Avery doesn't know is that Ryan's humiliation isn't just from the moment, but is the accumulation of abuse from Skyler and other guys like Skyler. They've trespassed all over his life, spit and stomped and sabotaged any degree of safety or comfort he'd managed to build. This is the true tyranny, not the actual taunts or shoves, but the exhaustion that comes from living with it for so long, so relentlessly. It killed us to be picked on, to be ridiculed for being something we weren't even allowed to be. So many of us first heard the word gay as an insult, an abomination. So many of us were called a faggot before we even knew what that meant. Not all of us. Some of us hid so deep that no one could find our weakness. Some of us were bullies ourselves in order to cover our tracks, or because we hated what we were so much that we had to attack it in other people. A lot of us had to suffer at the hands of people who were dumber and or meaner than we were, just because they were bigger, just because they were louder, just because of who their fathers were or what team they were on, or because they had the sheer nerve to kick us around while we didn't have the defenses to fight back. There was always a time before we were marked. For Ryan, there's a time that he played Little League with Skyler. Their mothers even carpooled. But that history means nothing here. "Did we interrupt you guys making out?" Skyler says with a playful disgust. "Did we miss the show?" He's so close now, too close. He takes the golf club and uses it to push Avery toward Ryan. "Don't let us stop you. Let's see what you've got." Avery feels the guy's eyes on him and has no idea what they see. "Come on," one of the guys calls out. "Do it." Ryan is coiled with anger, but he can't uncoil it into action. Not until Skyler starts to poke him with the golf club, making rude kissing noises. It's too much. Ryan grabs at the club, tries to pull it out of Skyler's hands. He expects Skyler to pull back, but instead Skyler surprises Ryan by pushing instead. Ryan's caught off balance and falls back on his ass, knocking into Avery. Then Skyler pulls back on the club, easily shifting it out of Ryan's hand. Everyone is staring at Ryan on the ground, even Avery. The other guys are loving it, laying on the insults. But Skyler stays quiet. He lets his satisfaction speak for him. No matter what Ryan does now, Skyler's already won. "You need to get a new boyfriend," he tells Avery. "This one's damaged." "Fuck you," Avery says. It feels lame to say it. Stupid. There has to be something better for him to say, but that's all he's got. "No," Skyler says. "Fuck you." Ryan is getting up now. Skyler steps back and putts a piece of glass so it hits Ryan's sneaker. "Let's go," Avery says. "What, so soon?" Skyler taunts. "That wasn't much of a show." Avery tries to read the expression in Ryan's eyes, but he can't. He has no idea what Ryan is thinking right now, what he's going to do next. It's like none of the rest of them are there. It's just Ryan and Skyler, facing off. "I want to go," Avery says. "Let them blame him. Let him be the weak one, if that will get them out of here." "Okay," Ryan says. It's directed at Avery, but he doesn't take his eyes off Skyler. "It was great to see you guys." "Yeah, fag, great to see you too," Skyler replies. Ryan and Avery start to walk away. The guys respond by knocking more cans and bottles in their direction. Ryan doesn't break into a run. He just keeps walking, and Avery keeps pace. Glass and aluminum are hitting them, flying all around them. The guys are whooping with joy. They follow for a short distance, then finally, at the sixth hole, let them go. Ryan despises how thankful he is for this. As soon as they are out of range, safely crawling back through the opening in the gate, the cork pops on all the words Avery has been keeping inside. "That was scary," he says. "But we're fine. We're totally fine. Those guys are assholes. The important thing is that we're okay. Let's just forget about it, because there's no use in worrying about it now. We're okay, right?" "I'm really sorry," Ryan says, "but I think I need us to be quiet for a second." He tries to say it gently, tries to make it clear that it's nothing personal against Avery, but Avery can't help but feel a little rebuked. Skyler's parked his car so that it's blocking Avery's, and it's a truck, so it's not like Avery can ram his way out. Instead, Avery has to do a 20-point turn and run over a sidewalk to get out. The whole time, Ryan seethes. "It's all right," Avery says. "No, it's not," Ryan snaps. Avery finishes the maneuvering and gets them out of the parking lot. "What's next?" he asks. Ryan knows he needs to extricate himself from what just happened, needs to step outside of it and return to the day that he and Avery were having. But the rage he's feeling is volcanic. If Avery weren't here, he'd be going back there with a golf club of his own. He'd wait until they weren't looking, and then he'd beat the hell out of them. Or at least that's what he wants to tell himself. These scenarios are much clearer when they're not actually happening. Ryan? Ryan hasn't heard Avery's question and doesn't realize that Avery needs to know where they're going. He looks at his watch and realizes he told Alicia they'd drop by in about 15 minutes. "Make a left," he says. Avery wants to ask more, but settles into patience instead. "Let it out," he wants to tell Ryan. "Say what you need to say." But Ryan's not there yet. He can't say it out loud. And he can't let it go. Cooper goes to McDonald's to get something to eat and realizes he doesn't have that much money left. This should bother him, but it doesn't. He barely even notices it. Instead, he sits at a corner table and eats his quarter pounder. People talk and laugh and push around him, but he stares off into a space that isn't there, his thoughts as anonymous as his surroundings. He finishes the burger in 6 minutes, then sits around for another 30, playing things out in his mind, talking to himself, because there is no one else to talk to. Death is hard, and facing death is painful. But even more painful is the feeling that no one cares. To not have a friend in the world. Some of us died surrounded by loved ones. Some of us had loved ones who couldn't make it in time, who were too far away or just off getting some sleep. But there are also those of us who can tell you what it's like to have no one who you love, no one who loves you. It is very hard to stay alive just for your own sake. It is very hard to stare into day after day after day without another familiar face staring back. It turns your heart into a purposeless muscle. The fewer connections you have to the world, the easier it is to leave. We need to turn back to Harry and Craig. We need to see them standing there. The day is getting warmer, and as a result, their bodies seem to give off more heat. We watch Craig's hand press against Harry's back, and we remember the miraculous feel of skin. Such a thing to miss. Touching his chest and feeling the heartbeat beneath. Touching his back and feeling his spine. Breath against our necks. The chill of pulling away. The furnace of wrapping together. 27 hours and 5 minutes is a long time to kiss. So is 27 hours and 6 minutes. Harry and Craig are conscious of everything going on around them. The sea of faces keeps altering itself, updating itself. The music runs from song to song. Michael has become the self-designated cheerleader. If the supporters grow too quiet, he gives them a rise. After football practice ended, there was an additional buzz of dissent. Not all the players, but some. But these dissenters soon grew bored. There's not much to watch when it's two boys kissing. You have to be devoted to stay. Tariq's consciousness is warping under sleeplessness. He starts muttering Walt Whitman to keep himself going, to keep his thoughts in sequence. Smitta hears him and starts to do it too. When Michael hears this, he turns it into a cheer. We two boys together clinging, one the other never leaving. Power enjoying, elbows stretching, fingers clutching, armed and fearless. Eating, drinking, sleeping, loving. Harry and Craig hold on to each other. Each of them, in his own thoughts, in his own way, wonders, how long can you hold on to a body? We want to tell them, a long time. They are young. They don't understand. It is natural for another body to become as yours as your own. It is natural to have that connection, that familiarity. We are ever regenerating beings, but we always keep the same approximation. And in this way, we can be known. And held. Hold on to his body, we want to tell each of them. And then, hold on to your own. Harry coughs. Craig takes it. He doesn't even flinch. Neil sits next to Peter as Peter plays video games. Peter plays video games, but is mostly aware of sitting next to Neil. Peter doesn't know what to say, so he leans. Only a few inches, but now their shoulders are touching. Now they are in some simple way together. Avery is happy to meet Ryan's friends, but also a little at sea. It's not that Ryan doesn't introduce them, but once he does, it's like he's checked out of the conversation. His mind is still back in the mini-golf place. He is still stewing in his own helpless anger. Ryan's best friend, Alicia, senses something is off. Avery wants to tell her, "It wasn't me, I swear it wasn't me." But she must sense this too, because she is extra welcoming to Avery, trying to tell him funny Ryan-growing-up stories to make him feel less isolated. In fact, of the four friends that are sitting around the table in the coffee house, only one of them, Dez, seems to be studying Avery a little too hard, trying to figure out what's under Avery's shirt. Finally, Ryan tells them what happened. Not every detail, but the general gist of it. Avery is relieved, figuring that this will allow Ryan to release it, get over it. Certainly, everyone's sympathetic, muttering an almost endless list of synonyms for the word asshole to describe Skylar and the other guys. But it's not enough for Ryan to turn it into a story. At the end he says, "I really should have done something. Smashed up his car. Called the police to report them trespassing. Something. I mean, I guess it's not too late." What do you mean it's not too late? Alicia asks, in a way that Avery doesn't feel he can. I mean, it's not like I don't know where he lives. Alicia nods, but then she says, Brian, I get that you're mad, but I think you need to take it down a notch. Easy for you to say. You weren't there, right? With this, he looks at Avery. Avery doesn't know exactly what he's being asked. The question appears to be whether or not Alicia was there, and they all know the answer to that. Ryan wants something more from him. I think you guys are much better company, Avery says, winning points from everyone but Ryan. We see how unsatisfied Ryan is with this, with Avery, with Alicia, with all of them for not sharing his rage. We know this feeling well. There were times we were subsumed within our rage. It didn't feel like something we created, but something that was outside of us, all around us, closing in. After so many years of denying our rage, denying our anger, it was powerful to acknowledge it, to allow it to fuel us, to harness the rage into outrage, taking the thing that felt outside of us and then shooting it back out from the inside. Part of the use of anger is this acknowledgement, this harnessing. But the other part, the part that was sometimes hardest for us, especially in our pain, is the matter of aim. That is, sometimes the power of anger is so intense that you will shoot it everywhere, even when, in truth, you should only ever shoot your anger at the people you are truly angry at, the people who truly deserve your rage. Ryan, so fixated on his hatred of Skylar, doesn't even realize that he's letting the hatred spill over, scattershot. Alicia asks Avery about his pink hair and how long he's had it, then asks more questions about life in Marigold. Really, what she wants is for Avery to go to the restroom or outside to make a phone call so she can get Ryan alone and tell him to remember what this day was supposed to be about, to remember how excited he was when he asked her to gather people to meet this boy who'd fallen into his life. But Avery doesn't leave the table, and Ryan goes unwarned by his best friend. What are you going to do now? She asks when the conversation has run its course. I'm not sure, Ryan says. But she can see it, clearly. His mind is still stamped with the word revenge. Neil knows what Peter is doing, leaning his shoulder in like that. He knows what Peter is saying. He doesn't move away. But he still doesn't tell Peter what happened, and still doesn't understand why. Cooper leaves McDonald's, walks back into the world, waits for night to fall. Craig looks around the crowd for his family and doesn't see them. Harry tries to focus on the texts and emails coming in, all the posts. He barely has the strength to hold his phone, but he types as many answers as he can, trying to lose himself in words, trying to pass the time in words. Harry's father watches his son and feels something enormous inside of him. His own father would have never understood what he was seeing, what he was feeling. His own father would have had more than a few things to say about this. But his own father was not, in many ways, worthy of his grandson, just as Harry's father is feeling, in many ways, unworthy of his son. What he feels is more than pride. Here, he thinks, is the meaning of everything. Right here in front of him, his child. Tom, standing right next to Mr. Ramirez, wishes we were there to see it. "We are right here," we tell him. "We are right here." "Is there anything you want to do?" Brian asks when they get to Avery's car. "I want a do-over," Avery thinks. "I want the last 2 hours back." Craig sees the look on Tariq's face before he sees his own phone in Tariq's hand. For the past few hours, Craig's let Harry be the texter, let Harry be the person saying thank you to the inexplicable thousands who've been tuning in. But Tariq's expression lets him know this isn't about that. This is something else. Tariq hands over the phone. It's a message from his brother, Kevin. "Went for a drive. Good luck." That's all. That's it. His family isn't coming. His family isn't coming. At some point in the night, his father must have decided. It had to have been his father. They've left. They won't be back until it's over. Craig feels like his skin has been ripped off from the inside. He feels that all of these people watching, all of these people can see what's happened, can see everything that's never going to happen. No reunion, no cheering section, nothing. The tears fall even before he thinks about them. Of all the things his body is doing, this is the one that makes the most sense. When you are sad, it makes sense for the body to want your eyes to clear quickly. Harry still doesn't know what's happening, although he has a feeling he knows. Craig gestures to Tariq to share the message with Harry, and Harry's fears are confirmed. Now Smitta and Mrs. Ramirez are also coming over, seeing something's wrong. The crowd cheers louder, calls out the boys' names. Hundreds of voices calling out the name that Craig's parents gave him. It all sounds meaningless to him. Something comes over Tariq. He can't stop himself from doing it. He tells Rachel to watch the computers, watch the feed, and he bolts through the crowd. This is the first time he's been away from Craig and Harry. This is the first time he's taken a break, and he doesn't know where the energy is coming from, but once he's through the press of people, he's sprinting like a gold medalist through his town. His breathing is heavy, and all his old wounds feel like they're on the verge of opening, but he powers through that, pushes himself until he's on Craig's street, in Craig's driveway, running up Craig's front walk. Then he's pounding at the door, really pounding, yelling at them to come out, shouting that he knows they're in there, pleading with them to be there, to come with him, to not be this stupid, to not make this mistake. "He needs you," he tells them. "He needs you," he says over and over again, until his hand grows too tired of pounding and his lungs grow too tired of yelling. The house creaks and settles, as if to tell Tariq of its own abandonment. The sun blinks under a cloud. There's not a word of response, because there's no one around to craft one. Tariq does not cry. He does not bother the house any further. He wanted to be the one to make the wrong thing right, as so many of us do. That he's failed is almost beside the point. In the rush of everything, when it's over, he will probably forget to tell Craig that he tried this, that he did this. We tell him it was a nice try. As he walks back to the school, we try to walk beside him. We want him to feel he has company. Craig realizes how much he was waiting for them, now that he's not waiting for them anymore. He is also surprised to find their absence is not going to make him drown. Harry is trying to be there for Craig, trying so hard. Just when it feels like there can't be anything new to say in the kiss, he tries to say this. And Craig hears it. Craig starts tracing something on his back. At first, Harry thinks it's a P or a lowercase e. But it doubles on itself, a heart. Harry responds with an exclamation point.
Not alone,
he says, his mouth still on Craig's.
What?
Craig asks.
You are not alone,
Harry says again. And this time Craig hears it. Neil leaves Peter's side, walks over to Peter's computer. The two boys are still on there, kissing. Neil leans in, tries to get a sense of their thoughts. He makes it full screen, but that only makes them blurrier. We should go there, he finds himself saying. Do you think your mom will give us a ride? I just want to drive past, Ryan says, to see if they're still there. Avery wants to refuse, but instead he silently complies as Ryan tells him to turn left, to turn right. There it is again, the abandoned mini-golf. The truck is gone. Avery can't tell if Ryan is disappointed or relieved. Maybe both. I think I know where they might be, he says. He tells Avery to pull out and make a left. Avery makes it through two green lights. When a red light stops them at the third intersection and Ryan says to take another left, Avery decides he's neither going to give in or give up. Instead, he's going to give Ryan one last chance. Ryan's confused when Avery shifts to the right lane and makes a right turn, even more so when Avery pulls over into the parking lot of a law office. What are you doing? He asks Avery. And Avery says, You're ruining it. You have to stop now before you ruin it completely. Cooper pulls his car onto the highway. He is leaving his town for good. He doesn't give it a second thought. He doesn't feel anyone there deserves a goodbye. Only 2 hours to go. More camera crews, more protesters, more heat, more noise. For all the booster shots of caffeine, Craig wants to sleep as badly as he wants to sit down. He tries to keep his mind from slipping into the bad questions, but at this point, he's somewhat defenseless against them. All of his unspoken, even unacknowledged reasons for doing this are falling away. Didn't he think it would bring his family together around him? Didn't he think they'd be proud? And wasn't Smitta right? Didn't he think this would get Harry back, make them a couple again? And what about what happened to Tariq? Did he really think this would somehow correct that? Would prevent such things from ever happening again? If anything, isn't he making it worse? Giving a reason for the camera crews to sell the other side's hate into the airwaves? Why are you doing this? He asks himself. And with all the other answers falling away, he's not sure what's left. We could tell him, but he has to figure it out for himself. We know that. It's impossible for us to arm him against despair. He must arm himself. Harry is so hot. He's been making the W sign for water, has been drinking what feels to be so much of it. It's really just half a bottle. And now he has to pee so badly. But all these people are watching. All of these people are here. He can't imagine taking a pee break in front of them. This is the ultimate pee shy. He tries to hold it in. It's painful. The police are blocking off the street now. The whole force is out, but there aren't really that many of them. There's no way to screen everyone coming in. Any fool could bring a gun. Anyone who wanted to stop the kiss could. Most of the people who are coming at this point are like the two who step out of Peter's mom's car. While there's no shortage of protesters, most of the people who are migrating here are doing so because they feel some connection to the kiss. In their actions, Craig and Harry are saying the things that they want to say. So they find themselves hopping on buses, getting into cars. They find themselves at the Milburn train station, where a helpful old woman tells them how to walk on over to the high school, and not to confuse it with the middle school, which is much closer. Now that there are less than 2 hours left, there's an excitement buzzing through the yard when Peter and Neil get there. They're astonished to see all the people, to see the wall of friends that is protecting Craig and Harry from the protesters, from any threat that may come. In the throng, Craig and Harry are just two bodies curving into an A. They are the steady center of a wider celebration, the first and tightest ripple. Peter and Neil pause at the outskirts to get the lay of the land. Or at least that's why Peter pauses, to get a sense of where everyone else is and to see if he knows anyone there. Neil pauses to look at Peter, to really look at him and ask himself what he wants. He knows he loves Peter, and also knows he's not sure what that means. There is no one else in the world that he wants to kiss, or screw, or talk to, or share his life with. So why, he wonders, does a part of it still feel empty? Why, after a year, isn't it complete? He's on the verge of it, we can tell. He is on the verge of finding that very hard truth, that it will never be complete or feel complete. This is usually something you only have to learn once, that just like there is no such thing as forever, there is no such thing as total. When you're in the thrall of your first love, this discovery feels like the breaking of all momentum, the undermining of all promise. For the past year, Neil has assumed that love was like a liquid pouring into a vessel, and that the longer you loved, the more full the vessel became, until it was entirely full. The truth is that over time, the vessel expands as well. You grow, your life widens, and you can't expect your partner's love alone to fill you. There will always be space for other things. And that space isn't empty as much as it's filled by another element. Even though the liquid is easier to see, you have to learn to appreciate the air. We didn't learn this all at once. Some of us didn't learn it at all, or learned it and then forgot it as things became really bad. But for all of us, there was a moment like this. The record skips, and you have the chance to either switch away from the song or let it play through, a little more flawed than before. Look at all these people, Peter says to Neil. Look at this. Neil looks at him and sees a big, nerdy goofball. He looks at him and sees someone whose mom would drive him here and will pick them up later. He looks at him and sees maybe not his future, but definitely his present. When Neil tells Peter what happened at his house this morning, as he will in about 40 seconds, Peter will at first be confused and hurt that Neil didn't tell him right away. Neil will see this, but won't apologize. Within another 5 minutes, Peter won't really care, because he'll want to know everything that happened, will want to be there with Neil, even after the fact, to give support. He'll hug Neil into him, and Neil will hug him right back, and more love will flow into each of the vessels, and each of the vessels will expand a little bit more. Ruining it? Ryan says. When he starts the first word, he genuinely doesn't understand what Avery means, but by the time he hits the question mark, he does. So before Avery can answer, he says, "Oh, yeah." "I want to get the day back," Avery says. And Ryan, defensive, replies, "I wasn't the one who took it away." As soon as he says this, we know Ryan has to make a decision, and that it's an important one. Because if he makes the wrong decision here, the odds are good that he will keep making it. Those of us who died angry can recognize the pattern. It is unfair that Ryan needs to make this choice. He is absolutely correct that the day was taken away from him. But now it's in his power to get it back. Only he'll need to get past his anger in order to do so. Avery doesn't know the stakes are this high. All he knows is that if Ryan's going to stay like this, Avery's not going to stay in Kindling much longer. He knows this is a shame, but also knows it's true. Please, he says, to Ryan, to the universe. Ryan knocks the back of his head into the passenger seat's headrest. Then he turns and looks Avery in the eye. I'm sorry, he says. Truly, I'm sorry. I'm such a dick. It's okay. We haven't passed the point of no return. Ryan shakes his head. Yeah, but I almost put us there, didn't I? His phone buzzes in his pocket, and he takes it out. When he sees the screen, he laughs. He shows it to Avery, a text from Alicia. You're fucking this up, boy. Don't be a dick. Guess she liked you, Ryan says. I liked her, Avery says. All of them. Even Dez? 80%. Ryan nods. Sounds about right. And where did I stand 2 minutes ago? 40%? 37? So what should we do? I want to get back up into the 90s. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? This time, Avery answers. Let's go get your aunt's boat, he says. I want to head back to the water. It's not that Ryan has forgotten, and he certainly hasn't forgiven, but he's remembered. He only has another year of this. Skylar and his friends will never leave. But Ryan will get away, even if it's as simple as stealing away with a pink-haired boy. Meanwhile, Harry can't hold it in anymore. He just can't. His body makes up his mind for him, and right there, right in front of everyone else, he is peeing himself. Once it starts, it's almost impossible to stop. In horror, he feels his underwear grow wet, the front of his jeans. Craig feels Harry tense, doesn't know what's going on. Neither one of them can really see down, not the way they're standing. Harry spells out an S, then an O, R, R, and Y on Craig's back. Craig responds with a question mark. Then Harry responds with a P, and instead of being disgusted, Craig snorts out a laugh. Smitta notices, but nobody else does. Harry wouldn't even know that she knows, but she walks over and adjusts the fan so it's blowing lower, right onto his pants. An hour left. All they want is for there to be an hour left. And then there is only an hour left. The sun is dropping from the sky, taking a little of the day's warmth with it. The local news stations are beaming their reports to the national news. Tonight, late-night talk show hosts will talk about two boys kissing. Radio switchboards will light up. Fox News will ignore it, then decry it. Wherever he is, Craig's father will make sure the televisions and radios stay off, the computers unconnected from the wider world. He doesn't want his other sons to see. Harry doesn't want to drink any more water, any more energy drinks. As a result, he feels lightheaded. Unbelievable as it may seem, there are moments when he barely knows where he is. He slaps himself on the chest to keep awake. Cooper approaches a big bridge that spans a big river with a big city on the other side. When we were growing up, this scene was what we always envisioned as the opening credits of our new life. Even those of us born in the city imagined this. Whether we were driving ourselves or in the back of a yellow cab, the city would spread out in its infinite wonder, each window glittering with invitation, the skyscrapers pointing like arrows to the heights we might attain. For most of us, it didn't play out as easily, but there was still the thrill of those opening credits that carried us through the harder times, that sustained our faith in a city that often didn't show much faith in us. Even as we were dying, we'd remember that first arrival. Or we would remember how we'd pictured how the arrival would be. Or we would conflate the two things, the memory, the dream, into one reality, and that would seem to us like a long time ago, but still a time worth visiting. As Cooper nears the city, we can't help but feel a little of that excitement, a little recognition of the escapes we made, of the finish line we crossed, only to find so many other finish lines waiting after it. We watch Cooper's car in the parade of headlights. All those cars, all those pilgrims. But Cooper's car breaks free. His headlights change direction. We watch as he pulls out of the toll lane, narrows onto the local roads. Right under the bridge, right near the joint where it juts from the land and into the air, he pulls over, turns off the ignition, steps out of the car. He's parked illegally and doesn't care. The sign right there says, no parking at any time. He shuts the car door without locking it. Then, without looking back, he heads for the bridge. We peer in and see his wallet on the passenger seat, the phone charger, some receipts and change. He's left everything behind, except for his phone, which he's taken with him. Our first reaction is, don't leave your wallet in an unlocked car. Then we step back. We have to step back. We have to stop thinking about the city, remembering the city. We have to focus. Up until this moment, there was room to believe he was heading in another direction. But now, there's only one direction. We yell at him, yell after him. Even though we no longer have voices, we scream at the top of our lungs. We crowd ourselves into a mangled chorus, and in anguish we hear the nothing that comes from our lips. We try to block him, and he walks right through us. We try to pound on his car, raise an alarm, but we can't do anything. Cars pass by. He is, to them, just another teenage boy, out for a walk, crossing the bridge. They see him throw something into the river. They don't realize it's his phone. We try to catch it. We cannot catch it. He feels the railing under his hands. No, the railing is under his hands, but he doesn't really feel it. He walks toward the center of the bridge. It will take him about 2 minutes to get there. Maybe three. He's in no rush. He watches the dark water undulating far below. He cannot see his mother crying in her bedroom. No matter what his father says, she will not let go of her phone. We howl at him, beg with him, plead with him, yell at him, explain to him. Our lives were short, and we never would have wanted them to be shorter. Sometimes perspective comes far too late. You cannot trust yourself. You think you can, but you can't. Not because you were selfish. You cannot live for anyone else's sake. As much as you may want to, you cannot stay alive just because other people want you alive. You cannot stay alive for your parents. You cannot stay alive for your friends. And you have no responsibility to stay alive for them. You have no responsibility to anyone but yourself to live. But I'm dead, he would tell us. I'm already dead. No, we'd argue. No, you are not. We know what it is like to be alive in the present but dead in the future. But you are the opposite. Your future self is still alive. You have a responsibility to your future self, who is someone you might not even know, might not even understand yet. Because until you die, That future self has as much of a life as you do. We can see that future self, even if you can't. We can see him. He is made up not just of your present soul, but of all of our souls, all of our possibilities, all of our deaths. He is the opposite of our negation. You are not worthless, we shout to Cooper. Your life is not disposable. You think there is no point. You think you will never find a place. You think your pain is the only emotion you will ever feel. You think nothing else will ever come close to being as strong as that pain. You are certain of this. In this minute, in this, the most important minute of your life, you are certain that you must die. You see no other option. You need to wake up, we cry. Listen to us. We fruitlessly demand that you listen to us. We shit blood and had our skin lacerated and broken by lesions. We had fungus grow in our throats, under our fingernails. We lost the ability to see, to speak, to feed ourselves. We coughed up pieces of ourselves and felt our blood turn to magma. We lost the use of our muscles and our bodies were reduced to collections of skin-encased bones. We were rendered unrecognizable, diminished, and demolished. Our lovers had to watch us die. Our friends had to watch as the nurse changed our catheters, had to try to put aside that image as they laid us in caskets into the ground. We will never kiss our mothers again. We will never see our fathers. We will never feel air in our lungs. We will never hear the sound of our voices. We will never feel snow or sand or take part in another conversation. Everything was taken away from us, and we miss it. We miss all of it. Even if you cannot feel it now, it is all there for you. Cooper is nearing the center of the bridge. Cars continue to pulse past him. When a truck rolls by, he can feel the bridge shake, can feel the air displaced. This, he feels. Even if he has closed himself into his decision, he is still in the world. The last minute, the last 30 seconds. Our ends were never this precise. We want to close our eyes. Why can't we close our eyes? We, who did nothing more than dream and love and screw, why have we been banished here? Why hasn't the world solved this by now? Why must we watch as Cooper steps up to the railing? Why must we watch as a 12-year-old puts a gun to his head and pulls the trigger? Why must we watch as a 14-year-old hangs himself in the garage to be found by his grandmother 2 hours later? Why must we watch as a 19-year-old is strung up on the side of an empty highway and left to die? Why must we watch as a 13-year-old takes a stomach full of pills, then places a plastic bag over his head? Why must we watch as he vomits and chokes? Why must we die over and over again? Cooper lifts himself into the air. Here we are, thousands of us, shouting no, shouting at him to stop, crying out and making a net of our bodies, trying to come between him and the water, even though we know, we always know, that no matter how tight a net we make, no matter how hard we try, he will still fall through. We die over and over again. Over and over again. Cooper jumps onto the railing, and he is slammed from the side. Before he can know what's happening, before we can know what's happening, he's being brought back to the ground, tackled to the ground. He cries out, but the cry is ignored. A driver, seeing what's happening, screeches to a halt, and the car behind almost hits him. Cooper is struggling. Cooper is trying to get back up. But the man on top of him is telling him not to move, to stay still, to stay there. Cooper feels the man holding him, feels the man not letting go. They get a good look at each other at the same time. Cooper sees a uniform, a badge, a traffic cop. The cop sees Cooper and says, "Jesus, you're just a kid." Other people are running over, are asking what's wrong, are asking the cop if he needs help. Cooper starts to shake, all of his emotions bursting out at once. Anger and sadness at having been stopped. Humiliation. Self-loathing, he couldn't even do this right. And somewhere in there, a small voice of relief. The cop is still holding the wallet he found in the car. Not letting go of Cooper, he hands the wallet to the concerned woman next to him and asks her to tell him the boy's name. She does, and then the cop lets some of his weight off Cooper and turns him so he can look the boy in the eye. "It might not feel like it," the cop says, "but Cooper, today is your lucky day." It does not bring back the 12-year-old who put a gun to his head. It does not bring back the 14-year-old who hung himself. It does not bring back the 19-year-old strung up on the side of an empty highway and left to die. It does not bring back the 13-year-old who took a stomach full of pills. It does not bring back any of us. But it does bring back Cooper. Less than an hour's drive away, Craig and Harry reach their final hour as Neil and Peter watch from the crowd. Craig feels strangely awake, immensely alive. His body is sore, his mind is overwhelmed, and the air smells like sweat and pee. But after 31 hours, he can't see himself or Harry dropping before they hit 32 hours, 12 minutes. And 10 seconds. He's even allowing himself to take in the crowd, to wave to the people who are cheering, and to all of the cameras that have gathered. Harry, however, feels like his body is about to fail. He can't bear the thought of another minute of this. In some twisted way, we know how he feels. When our bodies were failing, we'd often feel like the space between breaths was centuries long. And then sleep would be over in a blink, leaving us more exhausted than ever. He's tried shaking his legs, moving his legs, doing the small workouts they'd planned. But this is it. He can't anymore. He can't imagine disappointing all these people, can't imagine disappointing his parents and, most of all, Craig. But he can't imagine 56 more minutes of this. He's trying to think of a way to communicate this to Craig. He's trying to think of a way to ask forgiveness before he lets go. He needs a break. He needs something. Out of desperation, he wraps his arms around Craig, pulls him closer, pulls him tight. Craig does the same thing. First, just an embrace. A hug, then squeezing, harder and harder, with all the energy they have left. Only there's more energy after that, too, because he's still standing. He's still holding on. He's not letting go. Neither of them is letting go. They're making it more intense. Runners sprinting at the end of the marathon. Despite the exhaustion, there's the need to see it through. The crowd in the back cheers louder. The people in front have a different reaction. Tariq is near tears because he can see the pain his friends are in, can see them struggling. Mr. and Mrs. Ramirez must fight off the instinct they have to keep Harry safe, to protect him from any pain. Smitta worries about what will happen if they don't make it, how they will deal with that kind of failure. Sure, people will say it's amazing they lasted this long, but it will still be a failure. Harry doesn't have to write any letters on Craig's back for Craig to know he's going to have to hold tight for the remaining time they have. This is now the way things are. So Craig holds tight. And as he does, he tries to take in all of the sensations, all of the things he's seeing and feeling and hearing.